everybody, obviously. And I would have hated to have taught this lesson. Yes. Yeah. So, again, James, overview. I think I retitled it since I did my notes. What's the title on your paper say?
Interrupted Joy.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about that today. But just a real quick review. Last week, we talked about how language is a way of conveying meaning about what life is all about and where it's headed. So that's the purpose of language, is to convey meaning about what life is about and where it's headed. Remember what we called where it's headed?
Telos,
right? Telos, T-E-L-O-S. And it gives expression to how life functions and really how we fit into life, why we do what we do. And that's where language comes. We talked about the fact that we have a lot of contextual languages that we actually employ. And by contextual languages, do you remember what the ones that are kind of the basic contextual languages that we have? So scientific language,
political
language, religious language,
market
language,
battle
language. So those five are the basics. There are others that can fit into those categories, but those are, from what I can think through, those are the basic contextual languages we have here in the West. So in other words, and all of those languages are dualistic languages. They are all an either or, right? So for battle, it's about
winning
or losing, right? So, and battle, everything, games, sports, all of that fits into that. For political, it's all about
power.
So it's success and failure. So things like businesses and careers, that fits into there. Religious,
right
and wrong. You knew that one really fast.
Yeah.
So right and wrong, good or bad, either one. Market, transaction,
yeah.
Give and get, right? But always want to get more than you give. Did I miss any?
Scientific.
What's scientific? True or false?
Provable.
Yeah, provable. So those are the contextual languages we actually use underneath the language of English that we use with one another. And we actually have a dominant one of those that we have actually acquired probably as an infant. And we've probably acquired those, and we kind of see life as one of those. Everything is a transaction, or everything is a battle, or everything is a matter of you being successful or failing. And we actually frame everything in that. It'll be interesting when we start to talk about James, and then we compare James with the rest of the New Testament writers, particularly Paul, and we'll see that James never uses contextual language. Paul uses it all the time. And there's actually a purpose for that. So we'll see that. But God's language is none of those, right? Because God's language is not dualistic. What is God's language?
Connection.
But what kind of connection?
Cohortative,
which means integrated, right?
Yeah.
Cohortative. I know, that's a weird word. Use it with your husband or friends and they'll look at you like, what are you talking about? So maybe if you use integrative, maybe they'll understand that a little bit more, right? So, in other words, the connection that God's talking about is integrative, and we'll talk just a little bit more about that, in that the connection is, I fully receive you for who you really are. I fully receive you, and when I receive you, I incorporate you into who I am, and then I fully give my whole self out, which is part of you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a tree rather than a tube, a tree that takes in the water and the sun and the nutrients, doesn't give out sun and water and nutrients, right? It's not a tube. It actually incorporates those and produces something that's all tree, but also all you, all the soil, all the nutrients. And that's the fruit and the leaves. So that's integrative connection. That's relationship that God's talking about. That's his language. There is no this or that. It's not an either or. It's and. It's How do we usually say that? And
the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yep, that's exactly where we're going. So that is really God's language. And as telos, where it's where life is headed, is that all of humanity can live with God in being fully known and fully knowing God. So it's this absolute fully known and fully knowing one another. That's the telos of God. That's what Sabbath is. So I can put it in other words. Perhaps we did a whole semester on Sabbath and you're still not getting what is Sabbath. Sabbath is actually that place where you can be fully known and he can be fully known. That we can live together like that. That's God's telos. Therefore, any activity that does not move toward that is not life. So any activity that does not move toward you being fully known and you fully knowing others is not life. And that is probably this huge, like, what? Probably half of the things I do don't move toward that, right? In fact, what we're going to talk about is the fact that most of the time we're moving away from that. We're moving away from being fully known. But in Genesis 1 and 2, that's what life is. That's how God defines life. That's the language of life that God is trying to translate by using Adam and Eve. So Adam and Eve are actually our translators. That's what a priest is a translator who brings us to God in a different understanding, in our language. So Adam and Eve as priests were image bearers who were meant to incarnate, to actually give flesh, to translate for us so we could see it and understand it and reflect that fact of fully knowing God and being fully known, which is why we come to Genesis 2:25. So turn into your Bibles, Genesis 2:25. So we've already had this place where God has named, right? He's named animal, or he's named Adam. He's given him purpose, so he's tended him, and he's given him a helper, which is the other tending. He's paying attention to what Adam needs, and he's tending him. And now we have, what does that look like? Adam reflecting God and naming Eve, right? And he names Eve in the same way. Do you remember that the little passage that we talked about in 23? This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. How should that be read?
Excitedly.
With exclamation. It's like, oh, wow. This is fantastic. I'm so glad you're here. This is so cool. I get to live with you. That's how that would be read in Hebrew. When the Hebrews read that, it's poetry, and it's this beautifully expressive poetry of, wow, I am so glad you're here and I get to be with you. So that is Adam reflecting God as God made humanity. So God, of course, we don't have those words from God. But it says, and this is why reading in Hebrew would be so exciting, using the cohortative voice, he says, let us make man in our image. Wow, wouldn't that be cool to have somebody to live with that's like us but different than us? So now we have Adam translating it for us in there. And now we need somebody else to translate, right? The Hebrew feeling behind that. So we have Adam reflecting the naming of worth. And it's not just naming worth by saying, oh, great, here's Eve, and she's kind of like me, and she's kind of different. Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's being excited that I get to be with you. That's the naming of worth. And that's why when we use someone's name, instead of just talking to them, that we use their name, it actually pulls out. What do you think that pulls out when I use your name? Let's think about that.
It makes you feel known. Yeah.
It makes you feel known.
Individual.
And what? Where did your name come from?
It's a joining. It's a we.
It is a joining. It is a we.
It came from your parents.
Yeah, and why did your parents name that? Why did they name you that? What's the essential?
It has meaning.
Either has meaning or it makes, right? You are so
special.
They gave you a name, a specific name, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't call you, except for a very few people in the world, George 1, George 2, and George 3, right?
Yeah, really.
They gave you this name, like you are special. So when I say Laura Jean, I actually bring that to the forefront. I name worth I name the same worth in you that your parents named in you. So that's part of that. And hopefully we'll look at that a little bit more, but that's part of the naming worth, which is what Adam does now to Eve. So that's where we're at. And so we have now, we come into 24 and 25. Somebody read both 24 and 25.
For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed.
So the reason for them coming together is so that they can incarnate, translate to humanity, that life is all about integrated relationship connection where you are known fully and you get to fully know. That's the reason that man and woman come together. And then it says, I love 25, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. I think every time I've ever heard a sermon on Genesis 1 and 2, they just kind of like read that, and they never talk about that. And yet, that's actually the whole pivotal point. What it says is the quintessential reason, the quintessential state of humanity is naked and unashamed. That's what God made us to be, naked and unashamed. And we look at that, and we right away have this connotation of not good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Vulnerable.
It's vulnerable. So naked is actually being fully known, right? If any one of you stands up here completely naked, we fully know you, right? We fully see you. That's that symbolism of you are absolutely, you're not hiding anything, right? Completely known. And the fact that they are completely vulnerable, completely open to being fully known and unashamed. And the unashamed, we so skirt around this issue, which is what we're going to talk about today, that we don't even want to define unashamed. But unashamed is actually the joy of being absolutely assured of connection that's not going away. Like, you fully know me, and you're not going to leave. That's the unashamed. So the state of humanity is supposed to be being so open to being fully known and having such joy because I know that the connection is going to be broken. And all of that came because of being named and tended and made space to grow, to function creatively. So that verse right there is absolutely essential that we know that because that is the basis for where God is bringing us back to, where he's restoring us to. It is this being fully known and fully knowing God. God does not want to hide himself, and he doesn't want us to hide from one another. And that's actually not even a thought for Adam and Eve. And because of that, there is this great joy. Right? Wouldn't it be, think about it. If you knew for an absolute fact that you could show your whole life to someone and they would love you just as much as bone of my bone, what kind of feeling would that come to
this
you?
This is the covenant of marriage.
That's exactly why marriage is supposed to be that, right?
Right?
So there's this, oh, wow. There's a great joy in that. And when there is this great joy of being fully known and not having to hide and absolutely knowing the connection is still there, now I have the freedom to function, right? To function as someone who names and tends and gives space. It's very easy to name someone's worth when my worth has already been named and I know it's not going away. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to tend somebody when I've been tended and I know that's going to continue, right? Mm-hmm. So do you see that what happens with this perichoretic connection, this integrative connection is it produces joy that allows for the freedom of us to be creatively functional. And that's why Genesis 1 and 2 needs to be understood in the terms of functions and functionaries rather than materiality. So that makes a big difference, right? If I'm looking at Genesis 1 and 2 as the creation of materiality, I will lose that because the fact that I am created this way to function as someone who names and tends requires this, right? So all of that is this foundational piece of where we'll be going in James, what we're going toward, what God is restoring for us. So we have that in Genesis 2. Now, what I want to talk about is some of the neurobiology that goes along with that. What's really happening here in the mind? So we're going to need to talk about that. So hang on. If it becomes too much for you and you just feel like you just can't, first of all, you're not going to have enough space to write things. If you feel like you just can't do it and you just want to listen, fine. I will give you my notes afterwards. So don't feel like you have to listen. For some of us, for me, I have to write to be able to take it in. For some of you, it's better to just listen. So I will give you the notes because I think it's important and because I think there's a lot of stuff here. Mm-hmm. So the mind. When I talk about the mind, I talk about it being really the center because the mind holds not just what I think, but what I feel and my heart, the will of what I am, right? So we know the mind, and this is actual scientific neurobiology that they know now. They know, first of all, that the mind is an emerging process. So it's not a static thing, right? It's a process that's actually emerging and growing. It's not limited to the actual physical brain, but the brain actually has nerve endings that go everywhere all throughout your body. And it interacts, the mind actually interacts with the world both inside of you and outside of you. Right? You know this. You know that you interact with the world outside, but you also interact with the world inside of you, right? And that has to do with your mind. So the brain and all that that includes. The task of the mind is to regulate both energy and information. Now, when I say energy and information, this is what I mean. The energy is actually the neurochemical reactions that are happening within your brain that move pulses from one piece of your brain to another piece of brain. So that's the energy. There's literal energy inside of your brain. And it's moving pulses from neuron to neuron in different domains of your brain. So I think all of you know that there are two hemispheres of your brain, right? Left and right. But there are also domains of your brain. Think about when they do brain surgery and they figure out where is language coming from. Where is motor skills coming from? So there are 9 domains of the brain that they know of. So there are 9 domains. And there are neurons that can shoot from one domain to another domain. So that's the energy that we're talking about. When we talk about information, what we're talking about is any perceptions, any concepts, any conscious or unconscious things that are happening that are coursing through our lives every moment. That's information. So when I say information, I'm not talking just about literal verbal information. I'm talking about everything you take in the midst of your day, right? So sights, sounds, feelings, sensations, all of that is information. And the mind's job is to actually regulate the information you take in and the energy of where that energy is going to go in your brain. With me? Mm-hmm. Okay. The process of the mind is connecting the various functions of the mind with each other so that all those domains need to be connected, right, to one another. So that's its function so that, like Pat said, so that the whole activity of the brain is greater than the sum of the brain. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that makes a bigger thing when they're all connected than if you laid them all out piece by piece. In other words, the brain is made to be integrated. So again, that word, integrated. And you're going to see that we are created physically to be integrated just as we are relationally. So that's what you're going to see is what happens in the brain is actually what should be happening in our lives as well. So the brain is an emerging process, but it's also embodied, which means you can't disconnect it from the body. Interesting. I think maybe a couple semesters ago I told you about this new movement that's been going on probably maybe 10 years. Let me think about what it's called. It's called transhumanist. Has anybody ever seen that? Any articles on that? Transhumanism is a movement where there are some people who think that we are actually evolving to a place where we will only be our brains. That's kind of where AI comes from, artificial intelligence. That's not why artificial intelligence is there, but that's kind of out of that kind of thought. And they sometimes label it as brains on a stick. But what we know is the brain is completely embodied and it can't be separated from the body. In other words, we're anxious. A function of the neurons in the brain, right? But we know we're anxious how?
Heart palpitations,
sweaty palms, right? So there's actually a physical manifestation of what's going on in the brain all the time, which is really going to play into some of the things that we have no idea that we do that actually manifest what's going on in our brain, whether it's integrated or not. If our brains weren't embodied, if we didn't have embodied experiences, we'd be unaware of much of what happens in our life and much of what the mind is trying to tell us. So the mind tells us what's going on most of the time through our physical body. So we've already talked in Ephesians how important our body is. So it also tells you, when people think about heaven and they think they're going to leave this body, you got to be really careful about that, because God actually made the body and the brain to be one. And so a spiritual body is still a body. So all of these have consequences for our theology. So it's an emerging process. It's embodied. But really importantly, the brain, the mind, is relational. The emergence of the mind's capacity to actually do what it is able to do is crucially dependent on the presence of other people. The mind cannot work without being connected to other people, without relationships. We actually have the capacity to turn our genes on or off. So all
what does
of
that mean?
To turn our genes off, on and off. So a lot of people talk about, is that nature or nurture, right?
Okay.
And a lot of people say, so many of our things are nature. Well, the truth is there is no boundary between nature and nurture, because we can actually turn some of our things off. So if we have a gene that has the proclivity to lie, our human relationships can actually change that. So that our human interactions actually have a lot to do with what our genes do. They don't have to obey the nature of the gene. It actually can change. We can turn them on or off. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So our brains, our minds, are relational. They cannot work without other minds. And lastly, the brain and the mind is integrated. It's an integrated system. It's meant to be integrated. And integrated means that all those different, those nine domains, all of those subset parts actually reflect differentiation. In other words, all of them are different than the other part of the brain, but they are also linking into one another. They're also connecting. So they're both different than each part of the brain, but they're connected to each part of the brain. What does that sound like? Yeah, us, Trinity, right? Perichoresis. So you shouldn't be surprised that we are actually made, when it says we're made in the image of God, there's lots to that, right? So we are actually made physically, our minds are actually physically made to do the same kind of work. Be differentiated, you can tell one piece from the other. It's why we can do brain surgery on people and actually fix them, because we can see the separate pieces, but it's also linked. It's also why in those surgeries, sometimes something else happens, right? Because they're also linked as well. When each part differentiates itself from the other, it also matures. It also gets better at what it does, right? It grows. So the brain actually is able to grow in getting better at what it does. We know this, right? Because you do a lot more now than you did when you were 4 years old, and you're able to do a lot more. You still have the same brain, but the brain has actually grown. Do you know how a brain actually grows physically? It doesn't swell up. Anybody know?
More connections.
It gets more connections.
It makes more wrinkles.
It makes more wrinkles. There's more surface area. Yeah. What? Yeah, right, exactly. So we should love the wrinkles. We have more surface area to take in the sensations. Never thought about that, but... So each part is growing and maturing and differentiating itself, but it's also making more connections. So it's growing in both ways, right? The domains must grow, but they also must connect even more in order for our mind to function well. So they do that simultaneously. They mature, the domains mature, and connect more to the other domains simultaneously. As we age, our brain does become more connected within itself and mature in healthy ways, only as we connect with people in healthy ways. So, interesting enough, if I shut you off in a room for the rest of your life and all you did was study books, your brain does not become healthy and do more connections. Mm-hmm. One domain might grow, but all the connections, the integration doesn't happen. And therefore, your brain actually becomes sick, less healthy. Mm-hmm. So it's a requirement to have relationships mm-hmm. that are integrated.
Makes me think about the babies that are fed and changed, but
yep.
not
yep.
no social interaction.
Yep.
They
that's exactly
die.
Right. That's exactly right. So the neurons that fire together wire together, right? So if you have neurons firing from one side to another all the time, we're going to make a nice groove pathway, a big wrinkle that stays permanent, right? So there's actually... the more I interact healthily with other people, the more those happen. But the more I interact unhealthily, then there's going to be some strange connections there. Doesn't it fascinate you?
Yeah.
The way our brain works and how it brings us to the telos God wants us to go. So there are three things that the brain needs in order to actually do that, in order to actually mature in its domains and connect, in order to integrate and mature healthily, there are three things. The first thing is attention. And attention means intentional attunement. So our brains are plastic. They call that neuroplasticity. They're flexible. They're able to grow. They're able to make more wrinkles. And ultimately, we make more wrinkles by what we pay attention to. So that determines how many more wrinkles we are and what kind of wrinkles we're making in that brain. And the options for us for paying attention to are myriad, right? There's just thousands of things we could be paying attention to every day. The most important thing that we should be paying attention to is actually what's going on inside of us, which in this culture, we say it's just the opposite, right? Depending. I mean, some of you grew up in really healthy families and you were attuned to what was going on inside of you. Many of us grew up in families, in situations where feelings, things like that were not discussed or should even have. That's one of the things that the brain needs for healthy growth. Connection is attention, and attention to certain things, we'll get to that, but particularly what's going on inside of you. The second thing, Philippians 4 talks about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does Philippians 4:8 say? Anybody know? Whatever is
pure,
true, good, right, th- think on these things, right? So, attention. Attention to the things that are true. That's what helps a brain to actually grow and mature well. The second thing is attachment. And this is where your comment came in, Robin. The process whereby that we undergo when we're infants, when we're born, that we attach to important caregivers. And we attach to them in their response to how they approach us. So Robin mentions the children in orphanages where all of their physical needs are met, but none of their emotional needs are met. And that creates, what kind of an attachment do you think that creates? Disordered connection, right? Not a very secure one, right?
Certainly not placing value.
Right. They're not, their value isn't being named.
They're not valued at all.
Not valued at all. Not valued as a person. They're valued as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So attachment, and attachment begins, first of all, with skin to skin. So mother and child, right, within the womb. It begins with skin to skin. It goes to sounds, tones of voices, eye contact, body language, and it finally coalesces in language to give meaning to what all of those sensations have built up for. So attachment is the process by which an immature infant brain, and this is fascinating to me, it's the process by which an immature infant brain accesses and utilizes the brain of a mature adult.
Wow.
Think about that. It accesses the strength and the maturity of an adult brain in order how to learn how to organize and regulate itself. So remember, we have to have another brain in order for our brain to actually begin to assimilate what it's supposed to do. So our first means of learning how to regulate ourselves is to regulate our attention, to regulate our emotion, which is all important, right, for health, is another brain's functioning. So you understand why attachment is so important, right, of how a parent approaches a child. And, of course, that parent has bringing all of her or his stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of worried about all the time. I'm sitting here being, oh my gosh.
I know.
I know.
Yeah, when I first read this,
it kind of explains a lot about my life. Right?
I'm like, oh, I'm reading this, and I was talking to Christian, and I said, oh, I am sorry, I have really messed you up. I mean, that's all I could think of was, oh.
But of course. Attachment would have to do with pets or animals that you come in contact with, too. How you approach them, how they approach you?
Yes, to a certain extent.
Yes, to a degree.
Yeah, we'll get to the point where you see where that veers off. So every newborn comes in the world actually looking for someone who's looking for her. Mm-hmm. Every single newborn comes into the world looking for someone who's looking for her. Mm-hmm. Every newborn comes into the world wanting to hear, bone of my bone! I am so glad you're here and I get to be with you. Every single newborn comes into the world like that. Don't you wish we could teach this to every one of us before we get married, before we have children?
But you know, some of that happens innately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when the first time when you have a baby, they plop it on your belly. And
Yep.
It happens.
It happens. And I personally was shocked by it. My mom told me my whole life how horrible it was to have children. So I was afraid to have children. The minute Christian was born, it was like I was mad in one way because why didn't anyone ever tell me that this could be so wonderful?
It's not for everybody though.
It isn't for everybody.
We were born 6 weeks early and I'm a twin. And my mom never saw us for those 6 weeks.
Oh.
So she that's left us there.
Yep.
So I'm sitting here thinking, it's my twin. My twin and I were looking for each other.
Yep. Yep.
We kept finding each
right.
other in incubators.
Yep.
And she's still my person.
And that was your first skin-to-skin
yep.
contact.
Yes.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So interesting.
Yeah.
So when you think about that, Secure attachment is fostered in an environment that puts a premium on empathy, mm-hmm. attunement, which is attention, right? Mindfulness, and proper setting of limits. We'll get into that at some point. But secure attachment is fostered in environments which puts a premium on empathy, attunement, mindfulness, all that's attention, mm-hmm. and proper setting of limits. Mm-hmm. So far we know that in order for the brain to actually mature the way it needs to mature, it needs attention, right? You need to have attention. Mm-hmm. You need to have attachment, secure attachment, mm-hmm. and emotion, which is very interesting because we so discount emotion. Mm-hmm. Emotion is the mental activity that most fundamentally alerts us from transitions of state to state. So I'm sad, now I'm angry, now I'm happy. So emotion actually alerts us that there's a change in where your neurons are going right now. It actually alerts us. And actually emotion is actually the energy that the brain organizes itself around. So when we discount emotion, we're really doing ourselves a disservice. Emotion is actually the energy that the brain uses to organize itself. It comes from the word emotion comes from the Latin a motion, to precede movement. To precede movement, not proceed, precede movement. So energy actually is what makes us actually move. Move in our thoughts, move in our body. Right? When I'm sad, I move one way. When I'm happy, I move another way. Right? The interesting thing, and maybe we'll get into this, maybe we won't. We actually all have physical tells. You know what I mean by that? Mm-hmm. So there are things we do physically that alert others to how we're feeling. Which is really interesting. I'm reading this. Now, remember, I was a psych major, so you think I would know this. But, you know, you forget it, you know, 35 years later. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, oh, man, what are my tells? Like, I know some of my writing tells. Michelle edits some of my papers, and she'll go, do you know what your tell is? Yeah, I know. I say that all the time. Physically, what's my tell? So I began to watch the video from last week, and I'm thinking, ooh, I wonder. Okay, interesting. But it actually comes out, emotion actually makes you move in different ways.
You were in pain last week.
I was in pain last week, yeah. It's actually the primary driving force of our existence from birth on. If attention is actually the ignition that turns the mind on, then emotion is actually the gas that makes it run. Virtually everything that we experience in life is shaped and influenced by emotion. And I bet there's some of you that say, oh no, I wish that weren't true.
You know what I'm thinking too?
Yeah.
We're talking about infants, but just this whole idea of the mind, the integrated system, when we think of older people, mm-hmm. how important that system is. For older people,
yeah. And what do we usually do when they're older?
Right, exactly.
Exactly, yeah. So you wonder why they deteriorate so fast.
But Jill, I'm just wondering too, it just seems to me like for women, for all of us, this is like, oh yeah. For my husband, I think he'd be like, I mean, not as much, I mean, doesn't, I don't think the emotions are a bigger, you know, as much of a
well, they,
driving force.
They are.
Maybe he doesn't realize.
Right, but we see it though, right? Right? We can go, well, you're doing that because you're this. I mean, a lot of times, depending on how analytical you are. Also, that's because of our culture. So it's not physiological, it's cultural.
So they're
taught. Absolutely. Absolutely. They have definitely suppressed it. They will show certain emotions. Anger is much easier for a man to show, right? Because culturally, that's more acceptable. When a woman gets angry, yep, that's exactly right.
The root of that's exactly the same.
The root is the same, right? Exactly. So, But here's the interesting thing. Because emotion influences everything we do, there is never a time, ever, that we're not being emotional. There's never a time we're not being emotional. Which, for me, growing up in a family where you were not supposed to be emotional, that, like, just opens up all these floodgates. Mm-hmm. Like, there's never a time of not being emotional. So how much energy have I used closing those up? Yeah. Right? So the mind has to integrate. And to integrate, it has to develop the domains in maturity, but also in connection. And when it integrates, it has a telos. And this is neurobiologically what they've come up with, a telos of joy. Isn't that interesting?
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's my exclamation point.
Yes. So there's a delight in connected wholeness. Oh, I meant to bring this down. So I want you to think about this. When you look up in the sky and you see a full rainbow, yeah, exactly, right? Oh, joy, right? There's just this... Oh, I meant to bring down this picture that is a full, two double rainbows. Think about, why are you doing that? You see light all the time. But when you see a rainbow, you see the wholeness of all the light, but completely connected, right? You see the differentiation of each color, but you can't really tell where the colors end and begin.
Right.
That is physiologically what we're made to be. And so it speaks to us, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, and I actually think that's the joy of some of the nature things that some of us mm-hmm. find. I think that's the same thing. We see like, oh, that's naked and unashamed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's who we've been made to be. So that the brain, when it's functioning well, when it's completely integrated and maturing, there's a telos of joy. The natural progression of an integrated mind is developing in the different areas, but also in the connection. And the same thing goes for relationships, communities, etc. Those are all fully realized in the experience of joy. And then we know that there is this integration happening. And here's the interesting part. The experience of joy does not preclude there being something hard. So it's joy even in hard places. So you see this beautiful rainbow, but it's in the midst of perhaps a storm coming, a storm going, right? So when we talk about attachment, this secure attachment that the brain needs, it's not primarily the absence of pain that makes a secure attachment, but it's the presence of joy. That attachment is there, fully knowing me and accepting me and not leaving, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be in the face of, in fact, it most prominent in the face of challenges, right? Mm-hmm. Because when there's not a challenge, you're not even thinking about there's a possibility that the connection can be broken. But when there's a challenge, right, when there's something hard coming mm-hmm. and someone stays by your side, that's when joy shows up even more.
My mom used to call that sweetly sad.
Sweetly sad.
Right. Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, we would go see movies. Mm-hmm. And the sweetly sad ones were the ones that we really liked the best because this is what they showed. They showed
yes.
joy and suffering.
Yes. If you want a good movie recommendation, it shows exactly that. Mm-hmm. Go see the movie Lion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've heard that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bring a lot of Kleenexes. It shows exactly that. I mean, pretty amazing. It's a true story. So,
when I think about even when you're sick or hurt and a family member or friend is sitting next to your bed, mm-hmm. even if they're not touching you, like, don't you feel better? Like, mm-hmm. and then you're by yourself, you're like, oh gosh.
But oh,
it's just
so weird. Even for people like me who are great introverts. And I can say this because of last week's experience. You know, for the first time ever, I'm in the emergency room. I've been in the emergency room with lots of people, but now it's me. Mm-hmm. And And Bill was having a hard time being there, and he actually left. He decided to do all the errands that I needed done for Bible study. And I was alone. And I'm sitting there like, it's not that I needed to talk. It's just that feeling of, right.
Isolation.
Right, exactly. So out of that joy then, when you're feeling that joy of like, I am fully known, and the connection's not going to be lost, I have this freedom to be very creative, to actually function in a way that I was meant to. Now I can function and name and tend others.
You know, just a weirdo thought, solitary confinement is probably about the worst thing
yes.
you could possibly
oh,
right. do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So cruel.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Instead of that,
yep.
they should
yep.
they should stick them 24/7 with somebody.
Right. Right, exactly.
And then they kill each other.
Yeah. So think of
you.
Wait, when you think about that, even our prison system is really all about isolating one another,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And when you think about that, that's not rehabilitation then.
Yeah.
It's right?
Not
so it's just the opposite. So it's important that we understand how God's made us. It's important to understand Genesis 1 and 2 and then 3 to actually be able to make society flourish. So the joy, what happens with the joy is it actually circles back, because as we're experiencing the joy, it reinforces that anticipation of it coming back again to us. So this joy comes out, we name and tend and give space, and we're expecting it to come back to us. So we give it out and we're just waiting to get it back again, and we're giving it out and we're waiting to give it back again. So it's a shared joy. So that joy just doesn't go off into the air. It actually becomes embodied in you naming, intending, and making space for others. And so that goes in this perichoretic.
Okay, I understand that shared joy when I had my first child and I got with the extended relatives,
yes.
my parents, my brother and sister, and their kids, and they all loved this little baby.
Yes, and that just... Right? What's when you take your little baby out for the first time ever,
yes.
What's the best thing that happens?
Everybody comes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. They're sharing your joy.
Exactly.
That's what it's supposed to look like. So that when, so for an infant to have a secure attachment, to have the attention, to have the right emotion, that's all contingent on the infant hearing, sensing from the parent, I'm so glad you're here, and I'm so glad I get to be with you. Is there anything in Scripture that you can think of that actually really verbalizes that? I so love you, and I'm so glad to be with you. Can you think of anything? If not, we'll get there. Think about that.
I used to tell my daughter, because she was second one. My son was first, and everybody loved him because he was such a happy baby. He'd go to anyone, and she wasn't. As happy, and she wasn't as willing to go to people, but as she grew up and stuff, and we'd go out shopping, and I'd say, I just love having you here, because, see, your brother wouldn't want to do this, but you and I can go shopping. You know? So I would share that with her,
yep.
And I still try to instill that with her today, but it's a little harder because she's in Florida now.
So the degree that joy precedes and follows growth, the integration of the brain comes to its highest place. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's still with me?
Yes.
Okay. So now we get to Genesis 3. Now you understand the brain. Think about that's what's happening with Adam and Eve, right? There's this joy being shared. There's naming going on and tending going on. So we know that the naming and tending has gone on with God to Adam. Now Adam begins it, right? He names Eve. So next he should be
tending
her. Okay. Genesis 3. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from the tree of the garden. Okay. From a mind's perspective, there's an interruption. There's an interruption in this being joyful at this connection, there's all of a sudden an interruption. If there's an unexpected movement in the midst of you going along, skipping along, enjoy being creatively functional, and there's this this absolute unexpected movement. Like that, right? This morning, the chairs fell. And it was this interruption, right, of what I was doing. It's this huge something I didn't expect. I was doing something, going along, and that got interrupted. What interrupts first is attention. Remember, the three things the brain needs is attention, attachment, and emotion. And the first thing that is interrupted is attention, right? Adam and Eve's attention are on one another and God. Somebody else comes in and asks a question and all of a sudden gets interrupted. The serpent interrupts by asking a question. The question moves Eve's attention from being named by Adam. And now her attention is brought somewhere else. I want you to think about a baby who has their, and you know the first thing a baby does for the first month is continually eye contact with the mom or the dad. They're always looking for the mom and dad's face. Baby's looking at the mom, and a loud noise happens. What happens with the baby? Yeah, the first thing is they stop looking, right? They always turn. There's this moment. There's not a sound. And then a cry. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to find out what happens in the brain to have that happen. For Eve, that's what happens here. So she's in this joyous circle, and another sound from somewhere else interrupts her attention. And so she looks away. And the serpent asks a question to get her mind not on God, but away from God, even though he asks a question about God. Did God say you should not eat any of the tree of the garden? So what she is doing is now she has to think back. She has to recollect her past, right? She has to think about. So now her attention is on thinking within herself. What did God say? I want to make sure that I say it. I want to make sure that I tell him what God said. And so her answer gives a clue that she wants to be sure she's rightly remembering. So it's now become about her. So what has he done? He's already taken the tension off Adam naming her, God naming her, to now herself. So it's gone inside. Can I remember rightly? Can I tell him rightly? And she says, this is what God says. But what does she do?
She adds to it, right?
Mm-hmm. And really, she adds to it to emphasize. See, this is really what God said. So she's not intentionally telling him something she doesn't remember, and you shall not touch it. She's adding to it for emphasis, to saying, see, this is right. This is what I'm remembering. In that, then he questions, what's the next question he says? Or he has a statement.
You won't die.
You won't die. God knows when you eat, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God. What he's doing, a subtle questioning of attachment. Remember, first attention. He's drawing away her attention. Now he's going to question her attachment to God. He's introducing the possibility that the attachment that she has is not really secure. Maybe it's because God's not good. Or maybe it's because she isn't good enough to share his life with her. That he doesn't want to fully have her know him because she's not good enough. So maybe the attachment she has with God isn't what she thought it was. It seems to her, with someone questioning attachment, that maybe the attachment is not only not secure, but maybe it's going away. Now remember, What does a brain need? A brain needs attention, and a brain needs attachment, secure attachment. So what the serpent has done is introduced the possibility of non-secure attachment, insecure attachment, or maybe not attachment at all. So what he introduces is a new emotion that she's never had, and that emotion is shame. Shame is the impending possibility of losing connection. So shame looks to the future, that there's a possibility that connection is going to be lost. That's all he has to do. Interrupt her attention, and then question attachment. And with that, a new emotion comes. Oh, is there a possibility that this attachment perhaps isn't what I thought it was? Is there a possibility it's going away?
So that makes me wonder, did Eve sin before she ate the fruit? Like, if she sinned when she took her eyes off God and turned her attention to the serpent.
Okay, yeah.
Because otherwise, how could she be experiencing shame?
Yeah. So we'll get to that in just a second. As soon as we finish off, and then I'll ask that question again and see if you don't. I'm going to say yes and no.
Okay.
What happens when this new emotion comes, that there is a possibility that connection could be broken, now a new language is introduced. Room for a new language with a new telos, right? Because now that there's this possibility that a connection can be lost, now Eve distances herself from God, and she's able to look at God without the connection with God, without asking God, right? She's going to analyze God. Do you see what's happened here? Is there's this very subtle disconnection happening just because of introducing the possibility that there could be disconnection, and so she steps back and starts analyzing God, right? Questioning,
I don't know if that's really shame. It's more like doubt.
Okay, so
shame might come later.
So you can explain however you want. This is actually neurobiology. This is how they explain shame. You'll understand that in a second. But shame is the impending possibility of disconnection. Mm-hmm. That's what shame is. What we connect shame with is our response to shame.
Okay.
So.
So did she have to have a fear as well of losing that connection?
So fear comes then,
right,
with that, right?
Right?
So once that's introduced,
so instead
the
of
possibility.
It might have been more fear that drove her.
So fear, yep. We'll look at that. So let's keep going. And then we'll pull it all together and go, oh, okay. So now she can decide independently who God is and what he thinks. Now, all this time, I want you to be thinking, was there another avenue for Eve to take, even at this point?
Talk to Adam about it.
all of us wives, yeah.
So
she begins now to analyze God, and she'll judge him from a distance without interacting with him.
It's like her perception is that she's about to lose connection or losing when she could go straight to the source because she hasn't lost connection yet with God.
Exactly.
And won't.
Exactly.
But the perception,
yep.
It's like, no!
Yep.
No!
So it's because of her perception, she can choose a response. And the response is either I move away and I analyze and judge, or I interact. Right.
And we see that throughout Scripture and throughout our own lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So this idea that she steps back from God and starts analyzing, well, does God want to attach me or not? All she needs to do is go say, God, are you going to leave? That's all she needs to do. But like Christy said, that's what we always do, right? Mm-hmm. Almost always. Not always. Because there is always the possibility you feel shame. So when we say, we right away have a negative connotation when we say shame, right? The negative connotation actually belongs with our response to shame and not shame.
Oh, okay.
Shame is just the impending.
Shame mm-hmm. is the impending thought. It okay. could happen. Mm-hmm. And we have a response that we could have, right? Mm-hmm. One way or the other. We could actually just go right to the source and say, is it going to happen? No. Or we pull away and decide on our own. We're going to analyze it. And think about all the times you've felt shame. You've walked away from an encounter with someone, and you thought, oh, she thought I was so stupid. Oh, why did I say that? She felt this way. If I feel that way, if I feel like, oh, she's going to really think I'm stupid, I could go say, do you think I'm stupid? Right?
Yeah.
So, recognize that when Satan says this to her, remember he's the craftiest, and I'm not. I would love to get into the ontology of Satan. That's a whole other Bible study. But recognize that Satan is willing to talk about God with her. Absolutely no problem. But what he doesn't say, he questions her about God, and he wants her, he's gotten her attention off of God, and now he wants her to start analyzing God on her own. He never says, well, why don't you ask God about it, right? Because the intention is to break the connection. And why would Satan, why would any entity of evil want to break the connection between humanity and God? Or between humanity and humanity.
Because this was broken. Well, he wants this for himself.
He wants chaos, disorder.
He wants chaos and disorder. And what's the function of humanity?
Order. To relate to
people. Order. To create and flourish. Order to spread. Right? To name, to tend, and to make room so that there's more and more space for God and humanity to live together. That's what Satan doesn't want to happen. And so his absolute first primal attack will always be shame. It will always be disconnection. And he can't disconnect us from God. He can't disconnect us from one another. All he needs to do is introduce the possibility.
Mm-hmm. It keeps doing it today. Oh.
Yes. Yes.
I've been so rebuked. For not getting into the word and praying more.
That's the whole idea of what Satan does underneath everything. And that, actually, is where all sin emerges from. Is from the possibility that there could be disconnection. So let's think about that as we go in. So shame is the soul of Eve's story, and it's the soul of our story as well. So shame is the system's... So if you just want a great definition of shame, it's the system's way of warning of possible impending abandonment. So it's a warning. Shame is a warning. The problem is that shame also has a shearing effect. So that when shame is introduced, when there's this warning system, it also shears off joy. It stops joy. Remember the idea of the baby looking at the mom and a sudden sound? It stops the attention, therefore it stops the connection, therefore it stops the joy. And in stopping joy, remember emotion is the energy that makes your body move, your mind move and your body. It also stops you, your body. It stops movement for you. Think about that when an interruption like that happens. The first thing you do is freeze. So it stops joy, but it also freezes you momentarily. It freezes you. And there's actually within your brain a felt sense of stasis. You can't move. You can't think. What's actually happening is it brings, instead of integration, instead of everything moving around, it's disintegration. It actually stops all the neurons from flashing forward. So I want you to think about it as if your little circle of joy is like a train. I looked for ages for a great video to find, and I couldn't find one. This morning, Bill's typing me, maybe this. Think about a train. all of a sudden hitting a brick wall. It's going full speed, and all of a sudden hitting a brick wall. What happens to those train cars?
They all pile up,
right? Mm-hmm. They disconnect from one another, and they're a mess. Everything stops at a halt. That's what happens with the brain when shame is introduced. And you think about it. You think about a shameful moment for you. And your whole inside all of a sudden feels like you can't think, right? Like you're just like, that's what's happening neurologically in your brain. Is all the connections just froze. And not only did they freeze, but they just slammed together and fell off the tracks. They're not able to coherently connect with one another. The baby cries when that happens. So first the baby, if you watch carefully, first the baby's completely silent. Everything stops. And then this wail comes, right? Mm-hmm. Because for the baby, what's going on? There's just confusion going on in her mind that all of these neurons are just a mess. That's what's actually happening in the mind of Eve. All of these neurons are a mess. She can't now pay attention. There's a difficult time for her brain, our brains, for flowing coherently. If there's repeated exposure like that to events, we begin to start paying attention to those places of shame, and now we begin to actually start making pathways of shame so that if this happens over and over as a baby, as an adult, you will begin to have the same responses before shame is actually even introduced. So there was a sense of shame as a child over whatever might have happened. And every time you come to a situation that's close to that, immediately your brain goes to shame. And then the response is toward it.
So try to do an example. Like if you spilled milk and we did that a lot, eventually you probably like would avoid milk. Or like if you see milk, you're
expecting
like
people to get angry before they're really going to be angry.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Say that again?
You would expect if you spilled milk and you were shamed for it, you felt a disconnection happening, you would always feel like if you tip something over, you always feel like someone's going to get angry. And why are we afraid people are going to get angry? Right, because we feel that there will be a disconnection, an impending disconnection. Does this make sense to you? Can you kind of get into that, right? Like, oh, yeah, I know that that happens to me. I know that there are times that I'm immediately like, I'm going to that place. I know that people are going to disconnect here. Before they ever do. Yep. So that, interesting enough, remember, our brains need other people in order to, healthy-wise. But, so things we do for other people, we have no idea that we're actually playing into their shame channels. We have no idea. Sometimes we have an idea. Sometimes we just purposely do it. But this disintegration that happens can actually create now patterns of shame that we kind of fall into as we grow. When shame is experienced, when there is that possibility of impending abandonment and my attention has been drawn away, it's virtually impossible for us to bring our attention back, particularly as an immature brain, virtually impossible for us to get our attention back. Because if you break down the word disintegrate, dis means when one thing splits into parts or ceases to exist. Or, interesting, there's three definitions for dis. If we combine them all, that's what we're getting. The second definition is a loss of organization in some system. That's what happens, right? Mm-hmm. And or to do the opposite of. So remember that the brain is to be integrative. Our relationships are to be integrative. So Satan wants to make sure it doesn't happen so that we don't function as co-creators with God who name intent and make big space for him and us to live. Integrate means to make whole. So that to disintegrate means to lose cohesion or unity, to lose a stored charge or current. Physically, that's what happens.
And separate, right?
And separate. Yep. Yep. So, shame is where sin emerges from. So a lot of times we talk about pride being the underlying sin. Pride actually comes out of shame. It's shame from where sin emerges.
That's interesting because I heard a long time ago a definition of sin is it's a breach of connection, which is exactly, it's just a different way of saying it.
That's exactly what it is. So all sin, all idolatry, all ways that we, all of our coping strategies in which I indulge, of ways for me to say, are ways for me to satiate my hunger for connection, relationships, my longing to be known and loved, my desire to be desired without having to deal with someone else. Because that's where it hurts, right? So think about all of our contextual languages. They all say, let me live life and I'm in control so that I don't have to worry about disconnection. Win or lose, up to me, right? Be successful or failure, up to me. Do you see that all of the contextual languages are ways to do life that say, I don't need to depend on connection or relationship with someone else because that hurts. The pain of disconnection, the pain of impending possibility of disconnection is the worst pain that a human being can feel. Remember, we talk, I mean, Brene Brown talks about this all the time, right? That the most important need for a human being is actually not food or water. What is it?
Connection,
belonging, belonging. And it's really interesting to watch, to read all these books on the neuroplasticity of brain, and they all begin with Brene Brown. They, literally, you open and it goes, so Brene Brown has made, wow. So interesting. I'm sure she never thought that her research into shame would actually kind of come around into the biology of our brains. So, here are the responses to shame that we normally go to. And this is where sin comes in, okay? So that shame itself is just our body's warning, our mind's warning that there is a possible impending abandonment. But our responses is where the sin comes in because it's where disconnection comes in. And sin is disconnection, right? First of all, shame can only come from an encounter with someone else. So remember, our brains must have a relationship. They must have a connection with someone else. Shame can't come on its own by you just sitting somewhere. It always comes with a connection with someone else. But it affects the sense of self.
Could that encounter also just be Satan? Not like an actual person, but Satan?
How can I say that? Yes and no, but I would say that he will use someone to actually bring the shame in, which is, and that's why I don't want to get into the ontology of Satan, but it's why we have a creature having a personage. So he will use a person, right?
Creatures can't, even a past person, right?
So could even yeah, be a- right. So it can be your dead relative. It's still a person that there was an encounter with. It erodes your sense of connection and safety. So it needs to have that aspect of it. So our response is to feel accused. Well, not surprising then that the Satan, so we've labeled him as Satan. It's actually an adjective. It's the Satan, it's the accuser. So we feel accused. That's what he does. That's all he needs to do. And with that accusing, I think Donna said, there's fear, right? Because I'm being accused of not being enough for someone to stay connected to me. And so there's this fear. With the fear, then, my response usually is to move away. Right? I'm going to move away. I'm going to hide in some way. So a lot of times, if we feel shame and we feel accused, we might not physically leave the room, but we actually will physically. We look down. We look away. And you watch probably you step back a little bit or you lean away. There are probably some tells that you actually are hiding in some way, like you're moving away. How do Adam and Eve move away? They literally hide, but first
they cover themselves.
Who are they hiding from there?
Each other.
First they hide from one another. Remember, the quintessential state of humanity is naked and unashamed. Once someone feels a disconnection and they move away, they are no longer naked and unashamed, right? They are ashamed, and therefore they'll cover, they'll hide.
Why from each other first when Satan was talking to Eve about God, like questioning God's?
Okay, anybody get an idea? Why do Adam and Eve first move away from one another?
You see the nakedness from each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not connected to Satan, they're connected to each other.
Right, they are connected to each other.
They see that they're different, they're not.
Okay, let me go on, and then we'll see where that comes from. Hiding, so first they do that, and then they hide from God, right? Hiding is a desperate attempt to de-escalate that emotional pain that they're feeling, that sensation. When you feel shame, think about what you're feeling in your body, physically. What do you feel in your body?
Heat.
Yep. Almost always some kind of flushing, mm-hmm. some kind of like heat, panic, mm-hmm. Anxiety, all of that. And you want to get away from that right away, right? You aren't going, oh, wow, this feels good. not any of you mm-hmm. feels that way.
Also fear.
Fear, and that's where the fear comes from. All of a sudden, the heat has come, and it connects
well,
that.
You know you're in trouble.
That fear
somehow. Or...
Yeah, but trouble. What do we mean by trouble? Mm-hmm. See, here's the interesting thing.
Disconnection.
It's disconnection. Mm-hmm. It's disconnection.
Right.
Yeah. So when
I think it's interesting that the shame comes first, though, before the disconnection actually happens.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we're going to see why in a minute. Okay. So what happens is you're sensing not only that there's something wrong with you, but because of that feeling, that person will eventually not want to have anything to do with you. Mm-hmm. So you're beginning to extrapolate out of that situation, right? You're beginning to make a future that isn't there that we know of. There's a psychologist named Byron Katie. Anybody know who she is? Mm-hmm. Her big thing is always to say, you're anxious, she will always say, what's happening right now in the moment? Look around, what's happening? Oh, yeah. Because usually when you're anxious, mm-hmm. usually when you're afraid, usually when you move away, is because you're thinking in the future, right? What could mm-hmm. happen? And she always says, mm-hmm. what's true now? What's true now?
Count the things that are red.
Exactly, right, right. Uh-huh. Right, and I told you, that's the way that you get somebody who's in a panic attack mm-hmm. back to mm-hmm. reality is, see what's happening now, see what's true. The anticipation of abandonment happens then simultaneously with us moving away. It's almost this reaction that we don't even know we're having. We move away, turn our gaze, turn our body away. We're feeling exposed. We're feeling naked. Unfortunately, that is absolutely the opposite of what would help. Mm-hmm. What would help is actually to engage that, to actually go closer to relationship, to go closer to connection rather than pull away. But that isn't our sense. We're afraid and we don't know what to do. We feel then in that time completely isolated. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I am all alone here. And I think sometimes you can actually, I can think of some instances where I was so shamed that I almost felt like in those movies that... And, like, I'm here isolated completely. Like, no one's here. And so what will happen then, once we move away, is we'll begin to judge. We'll actually begin to analyze the other person, right? And in doing so, we actually move away and say, I'm going to deflect what I'm feeling on them.
It's like a protective.
Absolutely. It's a protective movement. Yep. And the funny thing is, though, what will happen is a lot of times we'll deflect that feeling and judgment on those that are closest to us, whether they were the ones who introduced the shame or not. Think about that, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody, you've had shame. You haven't identified it because you're not paying attention to emotions. You come home, your husband comes in the door, and he puts the bag down, and all of a sudden you're irritated. And you say, really? Do you have to put the bag down on the floor?
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with that. You're still working on shame, and you didn't pay attention to the shame. You see that? Mm-hmm. So that's actually what happens most of the time. But after I judge, then I'll retell my story. Because now I've got to make sense of life in a way that isn't going to be so hurtful. So life can't be about relationship. Life has got to be about something else. It's got to be about winning. It's got to be about being good or right. It's got to be about something I can control that I don't have to rely on somebody else. Do you see that?
I'm just thinking of people that, you know, don't want to admit or whatever, you know, like God or what goodness is, but it's about service. It's about it's about humanitarianism.
Like, Yep.
I'm a good person. I don't need church.
Yep. So that's where
when I put other people in this position.
Yes.
But I'm the other one, and I didn't realize I did it.
Mm-hmm. That's where I'm thinking through all the time. Like, oh my goodness.
Now I can see their shame coming out. Like, oh no, that's not what I meant. No,
yes.
I'm so ashamed.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But that's making me feel bad. Yeah.
But that's okay. There are ways to deal with that, right? But what happens then is when I retell my story. Now I've actually made that disconnection, like almost permanent, right? Like now I've had a, now I'm going to inhabit and embody a different story. Instead of the story that God says, I'm so delighted you're here and I love to be with you. Now I'm telling a story as life means I got to be right. I got to be good.
Contextual language.
It's contextual language. So now you know where contextual language comes out of and why we revert to contextual languages. It's a coping mechanism not to feel the pain of shame. And we walk away from engagement with God and others. And now you get where that. So this is going to actually help you understand, like, why sin has been passed down. Because I now will approach my baby with all of that stuff, right? And my baby has taken in my contextual language and passes that down. Now do you get why sin is passed down? Rather, I think so many times people have fumbled around like, well, why, just because Adam sinned, why do we all sin? It's that, it's this, it's completely brought in because we are connected and we need each other's brains. So, yeah, it is crazy, isn't it? But it's, is it not helpful to all of a sudden like, oh, wow, I read Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 completely now according to my life and not some story that happened about years ago. So here's the question, and I hope this will answer some of the questions that have come up. Why does God allow that, though? Here is God naming and tending Adam. He's letting him go off to go and do the same, and Adam names Eve. Why does God allow an interruption to happen? Think about what Adam's doing. He's reflecting God. He's naming because he's been named and he's been tended. His next step is to be tending Eve, right? An interruption happens.
Is that how we grow, though? Just
yes.
Like infants?
Exactly. Yep. So God does it because the next step for God is he's naming, he's tending. Now he's giving Adam space to grow, right? Okay, Adam, here's your chance. You've been named. You've been tended. Now you've named. Now you go and tend. I'm going to give you some space to do that. Be reflective. So first and foremost, this is first about Adam, right? It's his chance to tend. He's giving Adam an opportunity to practice that perichoretic integrated connection with Eve, right? That's where he should be doing it. Which will help his brain, his mind, to mature in its domains and also connect more. So it helps him while it also brings tending to Eve and then would help her.
Talking about how, like, it's space. Adam, how are you going to respond to what's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. So, right. So how are you going to tend here in the situation, right? Mm-hmm. Tending to something that's always just growing and flourishing, there's nothing to do, right? But he's giving Adam an opportunity to tend, to learn how to tend, because our response to shame is largely a function of how we collaborate or don't collaborate with the relational capital we have. So let me say that again, because that's really important. Our response to shame is a function of how we collaborate or don't collaborate with the relational capital we share with others. So what he's doing for Adam is, okay, you have relational capital in me. I've named you, I've tended you, I'm giving you space. Use that, right? Use that joy that you have to give that same to someone else, right? It's going to be received, integrated, taken out. If that's true, if that's what God is doing, what then would have been another possibility of this story? Interruption happens. God ordained. So serpent asks Eve the first question. What's a different story?
Adam would have interrupted her and said, let's go ask God.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is what God really says.
Right. So actually, Adam wouldn't even have to say, let's go ask God. Right. Although that's, so he's got two options. The first thing he can say is to Eve, I am completely connected to you. I am so thrilled you're here and I'm with you. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's all Eve needed. All she needed was to be assured that the connection wasn't going away. Think about it. When the baby, who's looking at the mother, hears the big sound, attention is diverted, stops, starts crying. What, as a mother, is your first response to the baby?
Look at the baby.
Yeah, your first response is to touch, right? Touch, reestablish the bond, and assure him the bond isn't going away. Now, as a parent whose baby is starting to grow, every time the baby cries at a sound, are you going to do that?
No, you start saying it.
You start giving a little bit of distance, space. What you're helping the baby to do is grow in self-regulation. I'm always going to be here. I'm always going to be here. And you always assure him, but sometimes it's more and more space away, right? Mm-hmm. You're growing him so he can always be assured you're going to be there, even sometimes when you're not physically there. But the first thing Adam could have done was put his arm around Eve and said, Eve, I am here. I am so delighted you're here. And I am always going to be here with you. Is Adam here?
I don't know where he is.
He actually is, which is interesting because I always thought, where is Adam? In verse 3, I got to think about where it is. It actually says, in 6. Read it, Karen. So think about that. Adam was with her the whole time. God was giving him space to grow, to say, I'm with you all the time, Adam. Use that capital you have to tend Eve. So that could have been a different story, right? The other story is, he could have, if he was distracted, he could have said, wait. I can go to God and say, God, are you with me? Oh, are you with Eve? Oh, Eve, we can go to God. And he can say that, right? That was the story and the response to shame that would have allowed development of Adam and Eve's brain, let alone their ability to be able to continue to live in connection. But they disconnected and they started going down the slippery hill.
And that's why they cover themselves from each other.
Yes, that's why they cover themselves from each other. Because Adam didn't connect with Eve. So what Adam's in his non-action, and this is important for shame a lot of times can come with a non-action. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a family, my mother never once in my entire life said, I love you, ever. Mm-hmm. So that not saying it actually is a disconnection, right? Mm-hmm. So when that happens, yes, obviously, there's shame. And my response is to move away, to disconnect, right? Mm-hmm. To have fear and judgment and all of that. That's what's happening with Eve. Adam's non-action. He doesn't tend her. And so they first cover up from each other, and then they hide from.
Okay, but I'm confused because you were focusing on shame, but when the serpent offered her, wasn't he offering her knowledge and more and like some, it's not that she was feeling shame, wasn't she just wanting more?
Why? Why did she want anything different than connection?
Because it wasn't enough. Because it wasn't enough.
Because connection hurts. But connection hurts, she thinks, right? Because she's assuming it's going to be broken off. The pain for a human, the biggest pain for a human being is disconnection.
Right.
So I want a life where it doesn't have to depend on connection. I'm trying to avoid pain.
Right, but if it was perfect at that time, then how would she know that she's not connected?
Yeah, we have a funny idea of what perfect means.
Because he was getting her ahead of herself.
Yes.
She wasn't in the moment.
Exactly. She was not in the present.
She was getting ahead of herself.
She was not aware. She wasn't paying attention to the connection that was there. Yeah, right. She was thinking, the connection is going to be lost.
She was distracted.
That's why the babies cry.
Right. Right. The connection's still there. Right? But she got so she's not in. This is why we talk so much about being in the present. This is one way we actually self-regulate about connection. The connection wasn't lost. It was the question of, oh, it could be lost in the future. And that's where she is. And being there, now that's her story. Connection's lost. I don't like a life where that pain is a possibility. I'm going to choose another way of life. What way of life? Oh, I could choose about what's good and bad. I could. So life is going to be about being good or bad. And that's, does that make sense, Karen?
Sort of.
Doesn't it also, you know, in regards to why does God allow it? Didn't he introduce her to free will, though?
Well, that was when he made her, right? When they're creation. They have choice. Right. They have choice how, and so that's the response, right?
Okay.
And that's part of it. Karen, I think as we go on, maybe that will get a little bit more clear. So this is to Robin's question. So, was the sin her taking the apple, the pomegranate? No, actually. It was the choosing to respond to shame by moving away. That's where the sin is. Sin is always disconnection. We've talked about this a million times. Sin is always disconnection. It's not behavior. It's relational. When we think it's behavioral, we're talking in a contextual language, right? Mm-hmm. If we say sin is doing something bad, oh, I know my contextual language is religious, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
If we say sin is not being a success, not trying your hardest, my contextual language is business, politics, right? Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I choose a contextual language because it's easier to live with giving life meaning as one of those that doesn't involve relationship, because I think I'm avoiding pain that way. I think I'm avoiding the worst pain I can feel. That's why I choose a contextual language. But it's also mixed in with, it's probably a contextual language that I was actually also exposed to as an infant. And so I haven't learned a self-regulation. But there is an antidote, obviously, to all of that.
So, just to be clear,
yeah.
First sin, was it when Adam did not act in that moment? That was...
So
was
both,
that his?
Right? That was his, was... right. And that's why we always go back to Adam, is it's Adam's sin. Because he didn't tend. Mm-hmm. He disconnected. But he disconnected first from Eve and then from God, right? So it was a disconnection. Which is why we always talk about it being Adam's sin. You know, we also move ahead of ourselves in the story. It wasn't Eve taking the apple. that was just a reaction, another response to, oh, I've got to make life mean about something else than relationship. Because relationship
hurts. Could he have gone straight to God without Adam?
Yes, he could. Yes, she could have. That would be the other story.
Both sinned, right?
Yep.
They both sinned.
They absolutely both sinned. Right? Yep, they both sinned. The funny thing is, I mean, if you're looking at it in translation for humanity, we see Adam sinning first because God had already named and tended. He was giving him space, and he named, but he didn't tend.
Right.
Eve isn't at the point where she's named yet, right? So that's why Adam is always looked at first. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
God knew all, yeah, of course.
So
he yep.
let it happen, and they chose that. But so sin is turning your back from God. That's what I think of sin versus that's doing something bad.
Right, exactly. It's disconnection from God. It's disconnection. Yep. 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 Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is why.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And this is why it's a little bit frustrating when we talk in the church about sin being behavior.
Yeah. Exactly.
Do you understand though why it's not behavior?
Yeah.
It's always about disconnection, and it's always about disconnection not just from God, but with others as well. Others as well.
And it can be within ourselves too.
And it can be absolutely within ourselves, which actually what happens is once we start that, we begin to isolate and we begin. I used to be so proud that I could so easily compartmentalize everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So there are only two ways that you can actually counteract sin. One is by self-regulating and saying, oh, no, wait. I know I have a connection that is absolutely safe, secure. I know it's not going to happen. That's self-regulating, going back to the truth, right? Which is why Philippians say, whatever is true, remember this.
Yeah.
Remember this, self-regulating. But self-regulating is very hard, especially if you haven't been paying attention. It's very hard to get your attention back. The other only way to counter sin or counter shame is by an intervention from outside, right? Adam intervening, reminding her, no, she is loved and joyfully loved. So God actually intervenes right after that, right?
Mm-hmm.
What he does is he actually pursues them. Now, has he been there the whole time?
Yeah.
Yes. They can't be an image bearer without him being there. He's never left. I really detest when I hear people teaching that that Adam and Eve were taken out of the garden and out of God's presence. Absolutely not true. They were taken out of the presence of the tree of life for their protection. So it's not a punishment. So God pursues. And the first question he asks is, where are you?
Yeah.
Now, it's not a physical where are you.
Yeah.
It's where are you in your minds? In other words, he's trying to get them to face the fact that they have disconnected. Where are you? Why aren't you connecting to me? I'm still here. Why have you left? So where are you? What's your state of mind? His movement there creates space for them to encounter their own and each other's intent about what they're doing. He wants them to actually face their shame and face the fact that it's not true. But in order to do that, they actually have to enter into that pain again. I have to feel that was a possibility. But he's giving them space when he asks them questions. I want you to come back and do that. Why he does that, he gives them an opportunity to confront what loving is, what relationship is. It's always a choice for relationship rather than against. So loving is always about choosing for relationship rather than against. And he wants them to understand that when you feel that possibility of impending abandonment, the response that will mature your brain, the response that will make you whole, is always responding for attachment, which means going back to that feeling and facing it, confronting it. Is it true? No, it's not. And with God, no, it's not true. Unfortunately, with human beings, sometimes it's true, right? Mm-hmm. But the will, what it means to love is to actually choose for it. I'm going to go to that relationship rather than move away from that relationship.
Well, even the question when God asks, you know, where are you, or where's your mind at? Like, even for me, that, like, the shame, like, oh my gosh, what's my name? Like, my initial response is, oh my gosh, like, failure, when he's just, that's not his intent.
Right.
Well, even though you're saying, face the shame.
Face the
which
shame.
Which is the thought you think that
right.
we're going to disconnect.
Right.
And still push, go forward.
Go forward with that. Right. Go forward in a relationship. Confront it and say, is it true? Right? What we do, we respond to shame is saying immediately it's true. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, no, go to the source of it. Go to the relationship and say, is it true? That's what he wants them to do.
But when we put other things before the Lord, it brings a sense of shame. And you know it's true.
I think of a prodigal son. Like, it's always going to be arms open.
Yep. Yep.
We always
think it's
open.
Right.
We're going to be like,
right.
He's
right.
not going to want anything to do with us.
Yeah.
And then he's like,
and Jill, I love how you opened last week when you said to be passed around as a baby and the last
yes.
person to hold you is Jesus. It's so
yes.
hard for me to see him want.
Yep.
Yep. You need to tell that story again. That was just awesome to me.
And that actually is, I think, exactly what the story we're getting told in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And then actually the rest of the Bible tells that story. Because God intervenes first by pursuing them, right, in the garden. Mm-hmm. They don't want to have anything to do with him. And we know this because they keep on with the judgment, right? They judge. That's what happens when shame comes and we respond. They judge first. What does Adam say? To God.
The woman you gave me.
Right. I'm sorry.
To be with.
Because God asks the next question, right? First he says, where are you? And then he says, who told you you were naked? And that is a pinpoint who, right away. It's about relationship. Come and do this in relationship with each other and with me, rather than who are you connecting with? You're not connecting with the serpent. Who? It's this invitation of connection, so that they can solve the matter together. Come in relationship and solve this. They want no part of it, right? Because they just blame. And anytime you see blame, judgment, it's more distancing, right? I'm analyzing you from afar, and I'm deflecting what I'm feeling. So that God then gives them what they want. They want relationship not to be center in life. And with that, if relationship isn't center in life, if relationship isn't what life is about, then we don't function well, right? Which is what Genesis 1 and 2 is all about, showing us our function as priests and image bearers who name, tend, and give space. So the curses are, this is what you want, I'll let you have that, and you'll understand that now the relationships are going to be a problem because you don't want relationship to be what life is all about. And so, right? So we say, so it talks about Eve and Adam having, Adam's going to rule over Eve, and there's always going to be this tension there. And then he says to Adam, and now you're going to work hard in the soil. Well, his function is gone. He doesn't have a function of naming and tending and giving space. Now he's working the garden. So we have this loss of function because we have a loss of relationship.
I thought he was always working in the garden.
He was, but it wasn't. He was working the garden in order to make relationship happen.
Uh-huh.
Remember, right?
No.
So now there's
working.
No purpose in it.
Yeah, he wasn't working against obstacles.
Right.
Now
yeah, exactly.
Obstacles.
Now there's obstacles. So God pursues. And remember, when he takes them out of the garden, and we could keep on going, but I do want to get, I want to get 10 minutes into James. He pursues, and he pursues throughout. From Genesis 3 on, we see God pursuing. And in his pursuit, he keeps promising them, I have for you this perichoretic circle I want you to dance in with me. I have this. And I just want you to look up two verses because I could give you thousands of verses that just keep saying that. But I think these two verses, these are the ones that just like, oh, this is exactly what God's saying. Come into my paragraphic circle, dance with me. Somebody look up Zephaniah 3:17. You probably know this one, and you probably know it in different ways. And somebody else look up Jeremiah 31:3 through 4. And somebody else look up Jeremiah 31:12 through 14. Zephaniah 3:17. Jeremiah 31, 3 and 4, and Jeremiah 31, 12 through 14. Somebody have the Zephaniah passage?
The Lord your God is in your midst, a victorious warrior. He will exult over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He will rejoice over you with shouts of joy.
So, And usually people say, he will sing over you with rejoicing. Have you ever heard it said, he will dance over you with joy? Mm-hmm. You know why? Because that word there actually means to spin around in a circle. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
The exult word means
yep.
to spin around in a circle.
Yep. So, it's the pericritic dance. He says, I will be dancing with you in my pericritic circle. I am so overjoyed with you. I am going to show you that this is where you're going. I will dance. Yep. That's actually when I don't know why. And I actually, because that's how I memorized it. And I looked it up and no one had dance. No one translates it dance. But I looked up the Hebrew for it and it's to spin around in a circle. Wow. With joy. So it's just this picture of pericritic circle. Jeremiah 31, 3 and 4. Loudly.
Long ago, the Lord said to Israel, I have loved you, my people, with an everlasting love. With an unfailing love, I have drawn you to myself. I will rebuild you, my virgin Israel. You will again be made happy and dance merrily with your tambourines.
Okay, and now read 31, 12 through 14.
They will come and shout for joy on the heights of Zion. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine, and the oil, the young of the flocks and herds. They will be like a well-watered garden, and they will sorrow no more.
Through 14.
Then maidens will dance and be glad, young men and old as well. I will turn their mourning into gladness, and I will give them comfort and joy instead of sorrow.
14.
I will satisfy the priests with abundance, and my people will be filled with my bounty, declares the Lord.
Okay, you have in their garden, you have dancing, you have priests. It's all talking back to what he wanted up for in the first place. This naked, unashamed dance of perichoretic dancing with him. So these are just some of the promises. So God pursues, God promises, and then God presents himself, which is what we have from Matthew on, right? We have when you first encounter that infant who feels like connection might have been broken, what's the first thing that a parent usually does?
Embraces,
touches, right? So that God actually incarnates himself to touch us, to physically touch us with Jesus. It's really beautiful. When what we have in the Gospels, and I think this is really important for the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have a picture of Jesus recapitulating Adam. From the point of him being, so when he, in Matthew we say, tells us that Jesus is Emmanuel, right? God with us. Mm-hmm. So it's this, I promise to be with you. I'm going to be with you. I'm presenting you here. Jesus is recapitulating Adam's turning away. He's going to do it over again for Adam, which is why Jesus is called the second Adam. Mm. So what was Adam supposed to do? He should have tended Eve. What does Jesus do? He tends. He physically touches everybody that he goes around. He tends. Like, you're right. He's the shepherd. It starts with his baptism. Whenever you see water in the Old or New Testament, it always talks back about Genesis 1, the beginning of creation. So he's starting over again. Demonstrates. Then he demonstrates. What happens at Jesus' baptism?
This is my beloved son.
And that's the phrase I wanted you to come with.
Right.
Jesus hears, listens, is attuned to what God says to him. You are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. I love you and I'm so happy to be with you. Jesus hears this. He takes it in. We know that he integrates it into himself because what happens right after his baptism?
Goes into the wilderness.
And what is he able to say to Satan? Remember, he's recapitulating what Adam did, right? All that Genesis 3, he's recapitulating it. Satan comes to tempt. And what is Jesus able to say to Satan?
My connection is God, yeah.
My connection is God. And he uses God's words, right? He's listening to God saying, you belong to me. And Satan is just a creature under me. And give Satan what he needs to understand who he is underneath him. And then go out and tend my flock. So that we know that his ministry from then on, when we, especially I think in Matthew, we see Jesus, his physical touch everywhere, right? If you look in Matthew, you will notice that he touches the paralytic. He touches the leper. He touches the woman, right? He touches, tending them. And then he embodies it by eating with sinners. He tends them by embodying the love that he has from the Father. And he loves them. He just doesn't say from afar, God loves you. He shows them, right? Mm-hmm. He shows them God loves them by eating with them. And who does he go to? Who is
collectors?
Yeah, the people who are the most disconnected in society.
Right.
That's who he goes to. Yeah. So we see Jesus recapitulating what Adam should have done, what Adam didn't do. And then, of course, in his crucifixion and resurrection, the best, I think, capulation of that is Hebrews 12:2. This is something you should memorize. Fix your eyes on Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of your faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. Okay, stop there. Endured the cross. He was on the cross. Tell me what he looked like on the cross.
Naked.
We never show him naked.
Right. Well, no. Not in this world.
Yeah.
I think maybe there's probably some.
I think there are some.
Yes.
Certainly not in the West.
Well, Michelangelo's David is naked.
Yes, exactly. And nobody has a problem, right? Going, well, some people do, but he was naked on the cross. What he's doing, he's turning everything around from Genesis 3 and going back to, I am naked on the cross. And then what does it say? Enduring the cross,
despising the shame.
That word actually means to confront the shame and say, not ashamed. I am not ashamed to be fully known by the people I love. I am not ashamed. I'm here. I am on this cross because I am not ashamed.
But David did that also. He danced in the street naked, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And his wife didn't like it, right?
That's right. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. That's so Hebrews 12:2 kind of just encapsulates what is happening. So this is why the Gospels are so important. His whole being, his whole life shows what it looks like to be fully known and fully know and tend to people, which is what Adam didn't do.
Mm-hmm. So where does his face come in afterwards?
Yeah. Yes. Because he gives the church now, okay, church, now you go do that. And he gives them space to do that. So, 5 minutes left and we get to James.
All right.
So I think I'm gonna start with James the author, and then next week we'll go with the background of what's happening in James. But I want to start with that. So James, who is James? Anybody know who James is?
Jesus' brother.
He's the brother of Jesus. I won't go through all the different iterations of what people have thought, perhaps, but it's always been from the early church on that it was James that was Jesus' brother. He's also called James the Just. That's because he was the leader of the Jerusalem church, very wise. Here's a nickname that I didn't know about and I learned. He was also called Camel Knees. Anybody know why?
Camel
knees. Yep, because he prayed so much for other people that his robes were always holes there by where he prayed. So we see right away, just knowing what his nicknames were, that he was a man for others. He was martyred for not renouncing Jesus as God. And it was an interesting martyrdom because the Jews decided to, they wanted to stone him, but they didn't want to wait for all of that. So they actually threw him off the temple. And he did not die when he fell to the ground. And so people started stoning him, and then some man came and clubbed him to death.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Now, this is tradition?
Wow. Yes, but pretty accurate. They're pretty confident that that's, like, wow. No one even doubts that.
I read that he was a rabbi.
Probably. I mean, they would have been called, he was the head of the Jerusalem church.
He would have been,
right?
He was actually,
yeah.
You know,
wouldn't he have been considered a rabbi for following Jesus?
Yes.
And
yeah. So, now, here's the thing. We've talked a whole lesson on shame. And we come to the book of James. So we got to talk about shame, right? You think James had any shame in his life?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that came from?
From Mary?
Well, he didn't believe that Jesus was who he said he was.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, first of all, he was embarrassed by Jesus. So when Jesus was alive and his brother, he was embarrassed by him. So I'm not going to have you look it up, but Mark 3 tells us about a time that actually Mary and his brothers and sisters all came to his ministry. Mm-hmm. And it says that the whole town was embarrassed by him, his hometown. And Mary and the brothers are coming there to kind of say, Jesus, come on, you know, stop embarrassing us. Mm-hmm. And that's the point where the story you know is where Jesus says, who are my mother and brothers?
Right.
This is why he says this, because he's being rejected by his family. So James is a part of that. So James was embarrassed by him. We also know that at one point, James and his brothers go to him and say, well, if you think you're such a big... So my translation, this is what's underneath the Hebrew or the Greek. If you think you're such a big shot and you have these big powers... Why don't you go to Jerusalem and show them off? Doing them in Galilee isn't going to do you any good. There's nobody worth anything here. You got to go to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, if I go to Jerusalem, I know I'll be killed. Mm-hmm. And the brothers continue to urge him to go on. Mm-hmm. This is how the commentaries look at it. They wanted him to die.
Mm-hmm.
He was an embarrassment to them. Right. He thought he was somebody. He was basically saying he was God. This is my brother. And so they're urging him. You should go. You should go. You think James has any shame?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lastly, Jesus is dying on the cross. His mother is at the crucifixion, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody's standing next to his mother.
John.
By tradition. What does Jesus say to John?
Behold your mother.
Behold your son. What he's doing is he's asking John to take care of his mother.
Mm-hmm. Not his brothers.
Not his brothers. That would be the biggest shame of all. James was not asked to take care of his own mother. In Hebrew society, in the Hellenistic society, that's huge. Huge. There's a lot of shame that James has lived under. So we know that James understands this idea. But remember, shame can only be usually fought against with intervention. Where's James' intervention? When does James come to belief in his brother?
After his resurrection.
Yeah. Why?
Because of an encounter with him.
Yeah, but is it a resurrection somebody tells him about? He gets to see him resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus himself intervenes and says, here I am, James.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's in 1 Corinthians 15. We also see that James waits with the disciples at Pentecost for the Holy Spirit to come upon him. So that not only does Jesus show himself, Jesus sends himself to James and intervenes with that shame. We know that James embraces that connection because of the way James opens up his letter. Mm-hmm. It says, anybody read it? James 1:1.
The bondservant of the Lord and of Jesus Christ.
Right. Bondservant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. What is he doing? He is actually claiming, I am the servant of Jesus, who is my Lord. Mm-hmm. Completely saying, here's my connection, he is my Lord. I think actually the most fascinating thing is, anybody have any idea what the biggest key word is? What the one word that is out throughout most of James?
Grace.
Nope.
Word.
Nope.
Grace. Judgment.
Nope. And I've never seen this in any commentary, but I count it all. And I.
Oh.
Forgiveness?
No. The word is brother.
Wow.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or brethren.
Same word.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he actually uses sisters too. James is one of the few people who uses brothers and sisters. Brother. He talks right to that point. And now James sees connection everywhere. Everyone. I'm looking at you as my brother. I'm looking at you as my brother. I will never again feel disconnected. And I will never make anyone feel disconnected. And that underlies where James is going with his letter there. We will talk about the recipients and the social structure next week as you get into a little bit more of James 1. I want us to go on our confession to open up your... I think this is necessary if we've talked about shame and many of us have come to that point where we realize, wow, I have probably helped in that in some aspects. So I want to end with this every week or put it somewhere within. Everybody have it? So let's go to the Father. Most merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed. By what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry and we humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us, that we may delight in your will and walk in your ways to the glory of your name. Amen.